Now, this talk really comes out of some older work I've been doing, but it's a subject that continues to engage my attention. And let's hope we're going to get the lights here a little bit. And I begin this chat with two words, two definitions, from Sebastian de Covarrubias's Tesoro de la Lengua Castellana, or Española, one of the first Spanish dictionaries ever produced that was printed in 1611. And the first word, you can see it on the screen, is plaza, from the Latin platea, a wide and spacious place inside the town, a public space where comestibles are sold and the commerce of citizens in nearby residents is conducted. Formerly, there were plazas at the entrances to cities, and it was there that travelers came to do business and commerce. Judges also had their tribunals in the same plazas in order to render justice. So the original Spanish is on the screen. And then the other word, second word, is policía, an urban, courtly term, police council, which governs the small things of the city, including adornment and cleanliness. It derives from the Greek noun politeia, res publica, meaning polity, the urbane, the polite, politics, the art and manner of governing the city and the republic, the definitions. Now, at first glance, these words, one a concept, the other a place, might appear unconnected. At a metaphorical level, however, plaza and policía are inextricably linked. As Covarrubias suggests, the plaza is a public space, one that serves both as market and as a place where judges render the judgments necessary to enforce justice and thus maintain public order. Such judgments rarely relate directly to policía, a term that, starting in the 15th century, conjured up two different but somehow overlapping clusters of ideas. The first was connected to the notion of civility, or proper behavior. A good Spanish citizen synonym would be cortesía, and as applied to individuals, and which later find expression in such advice books as Lucas Gracián Dantesco's best-selling Galateo Español of 1582, one of these books, like many of them published in the 16th century, on how to don't blow your nose in public and the like. As for the second set of meanings attached to the word policía, this term conjured up the idea of good governance and public order, and over time, with those individuals responsible for the maintenance of that order. You see those little cars going around, and it says police on the side. Moreover, it was this second set of meanings, call it the public face of policía, that had the greatest resonance in Spanish America. In this way, therefore, plaza and policía are inextricably linked, inasmuch as the plaza was quite literally the place from which the city was governed, justice and order enacted and maintained. It follows that a well-constructed plaza, more than a symbol of architectural harmony, served also as an emblem of city life, as it embodied the space where, both literally and figuratively, the city's governance, its res publica, was on display. By extension, therefore, the plaza also served as the symbol of the imperium, the Spanish Habsburgs, starting in the 16th century, endeavored to impose on the New World. Now, so defined, the plaza exerts a symbolic power that extends well beyond its actual confines. It rather approximates what the British geographer Peter Jackson has called a map of meaning. And in this presentation, I aim to explore what meanings lurk in the plaza. And I'll do so with particular reference to those in Spanish colonial America. However, I want to emphasize that the particular meanings and the particular roles attached to the plaza were by no means uniform. given the heterogeneous character of Spanish colonial society, a complex and ever-changing amalgam of Spaniards, Creoles, Indios, Mestizos, Mulatos, Blacks, and more. The plaza clearly meant different things. And let me give you a picture of a plaza from 16th century one, 16th century drawing. The plaza clearly meant different things to different people. And I can readily imagine that, seen through the eyes of a Spanish official, the plaza represented justice, civic order, and sound municipal governance, that is, policía. In contrast, natives, los indios, natives might have easily considered the same space a symbol of injustice and oppression, especially in cities such as Tenochtitlan or Cusco, where Spaniards had appropriated pre-existing indigenous plazas for their own particular use. It is also easy to imagine that the meanings attached to the plaza changed in accordance to the time of day, the season, as well as the religious calendar. These meanings are also likely to have varied in accordance with the particular activities to which the plaza played host. Records indicate that plazas served variously and often simultaneously as a marketplace, a meeting place, a parade ground, the site of public executions, a stage for theatrical and musical entertainments, as well as a space for important religious celebrations. They're all regularly enacted in that same space. And these activities were so varied and so numerous that it's difficult for us to recover them all. But despite such challenges, I hope this presentation aims underscoring the multifaceted character of the plaza itself. Now, the importance of the plaza in both Spain and America is already well known, and so too is the town. As I've written elsewhere, and I'll show you a little map, the town or pueblo constituted the basic administrative unit or building block of Spain's empire in the New World. The town also served as the mechanism through which Spaniards would take possession of and govern those regions it endeavored to conquer and to control. The legal instrument that granted the town and its governors such extraordinary power was called the regalia, a royal privilege that empowered municipal governments to administer justice, both civil and criminal, not only within the town proper, but also in adjacent villages lying within the town's término, or its jurisdiction, so essentially the suburbs. The town, in this sense, was an imperial instrument par excellence, an idea neatly summarized by the 16th century chronicler Francisco López de Gómara with the phrase, when he was thinking about the policy of Spain's policy of conquest, he observed, and I quote, "Whoever does not found a town will not have a good conquest. And if you do not conquer the land, the natives will not be converted." Thus, the maxim to conquer, conquistar, to conquer, found a town, end of quote. It's also worth remembering, it's something that the English didn't necessarily, or the French, let alone the Dutch, or we've talked about this before, didn't necessarily always do, or the Portuguese. It's also worth remembering that whenever Spaniards founded towns in the Americas, and they did so starting as early as 1502, Columbus did not found a town. The process of town foundation began with the so-called Act of Foundation, a ritualized ceremonial procedure which transformed an existing space into what Spaniards regarded as a town. Thus, this ceremony was never quite codified, varied from place to place as would-be town founders tended to improvise as they went about their work. But in general, it included several components. One was the act of possession, whereby the captain, think of Pizarro, think Cortez, think Pedro de Alvarado in the middle of Guatemala. The list goes on. The act of possession where the captain, brandishing his sword, laid claim to a particular plot of land. Next came a judicial act in which a group of soldiers, guys, these thugs that went with these guys, transformed themselves into a body of citizens and proceeded to elect an alcalde, kind of mayor, and a cabildo, or town council, and in doing so constituted themselves as a civitas, or a res publica, subject to royal jurisdiction and responsible for the implementation of Spanish law in the town that had just been created and duly named. Because when you do that, you're going to generally say, this is going to be the town of, let's say, Columbus. Boom. As for the urbs, the actual laying out or planning of the town as a physical unit, this process began when the newly elected alcalde, let's say, I think I'll go back here, erected a picota or arroyo. We would call it a gallows, but it's not really quite a gallows, although it's doubled as such. Can you see the what kind of a tower-looking thing? I can't see it there to the right. It was a kind of a pillory, and then that pillory was meant to serve as a symbol of policia. And if they didn't, they had to sometimes use a tree trunk. They didn't erect the column itself. And then they sanctified that. They sanctified that picoto royo by striking it three times. The captain would hit it. One, two, three. And I thought a long time why it's three times, but it's clearly in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, though it's never been written down. But why three times? Unless some medievalist or some classicist here can tell me why the magic number three, I'll change my theory about that. But that's my theory about it. And I have a modern arroyo in a Peruvian town, what's it look like? And the next step was to create the overall layout, or the traza, as they call it, of the new community. And this occurred when the alcalde, again with his crusty little sword, traced on the ground the location and shape of the plaza, the site of the church and other public buildings, the plan of the streets, together with the lots that were to be distributed to the town's new vecinos, or citizens, these soldiers that had been magically transformed now into citizens. And all of that would be recorded by a notary, who in some instances would also create a map known as a foundational plan. This is the connection to the theme of this of your year's gatherings, of what this newly imagined town was going to be like. And for Donaghy, I brought several Argentinian images here. The most famous and the most reproduced of these plans is that of San Juan de la Frontera in what is now Argentina, dating from 1562. And there, this town has just been created. It was not like this. You can see the plaza, the picoto, the royo right there in the middle, the plan of the blocks that's surrounding it, and kind of the idea of where they're going to put buildings. But these buildings, when this town was mapped, did not exist. That's me. I'm going to shut this off. And you can see it again. And whenever they make a town foundation, these maps would come into existence. And this is another one for the town of Mendoza, also in western Argentina, and the place where the good wine comes from. Very important. But on the surface, this particular ceremony resembled the Roman foundation rituals to the extent that Romulus, in founding Rome, began by indicating what's called the comitium, the meeting place of the kind of the community in the underworld. They start really in the middle. At this point, however, Spanish ritual separated itself from the Roman to the extent that Spaniards, unlike Romulus, made no effort to trace with a plow the outline of the city's or the town's future walls. Rather, the Spanish foundation ceremony focused on the plaza, as this was the space par excellence that defined the town, both as a built structure, or urbs, and as a human construct, or civitas. However, elements of the old Roman ceremony appeared when the alcalde, having created the town proper, ordered his subordinates to erect a series of markers called mojones. And these often took the shape of form of crosses that were built, and they would be marked out along the boundaries of the término, or jurisdiction, in the sense the suburbs, the what was outside of the town proper, but was still fell within jurisdictions under the town. And it's interesting to conceive of these crosses out there as serving as some kind of a forward spiritual boundary, or defensive perimeter that separated the space that encompassed the town and its outlying sections from that uncivilized, yet to be urbanized, spaces occupied by what David Weber called los indios bárbaros, the barbaric Indians that had yet not been brought under the, into the compass of the towns. And Roman practice may also have served as a precedent for the picotto, the rollo, because if you remember that, according to traditional Christian iconography, the Roman governor of Jerusalem, Pilate, had Jesus tied to a pillar and whipped prior to marching him off to the Mount of Execution, known to us as Golgotha Hill. We don't know what's exactly in the minds of these characters when you're creating these towns, but there's these Roman precedents. Now, given the centrality and, dare I say, primacy that the plaza enjoyed in the foundation of towns, it was logical that in 1571, Philip II, when he issued a series of ordinances meant to promote good governance throughout all of the Indies, and within these ordinances, the section on the foundation of towns accorded special attention to the plaza. And according to this document, and the parts of it are on the screen, the plaza was either to be square or rectangular, in which case they were ideally to have a perimeter ratio of 2 to 3, a shape that derived from the Roman architect, Vitruvius, and which the ordinances proclaimed were, and I quote, the best for fiestas in which horses were used. You can think, a square thing is a little tight. You can have a little kind of a horse race around a rectangular one. And the size of the plaza was also to be proportioned to population. It was to be surrounded by porticos to be used for mercantile purposes. And it was further stated that for reasons of ornato, what kind of adornment, best translated perhaps as urban embellishment, but which also conjured up notions of dignity, prestige, that plaza was also to serve as the site of the principal church, the town hall, the prison, and of course the pillory, each symbolizing different aspects of the politeia that the king and his ministers back in Spain were eager to promote in the New World. Now, in practice, few of the cities founded by Spaniards after these ordinances were decreed had plazas exactly modeled upon those the ordinances stipulated. But at the same time, few of these new creations, in keeping what was already established practice, failed to accord the plaza a central place. So plazas preexisted these ordinances, but they more or less kind of regularized after they were decreed. And contemporary sources further underscore the plaza's importance in the conduct of urban life. Compared to other parts of the town, which were generally constructed without official review, the plaza was subject to scrupulous attention, as the number of plans currently housed in the archive, the General Archive in the Indies in Seville, readily attests. And you know, when they wanted to reform the main square or Zocalo of Mexico City in the 1570s, this is the kind of stuff they were sending off to Spain. Said, this is what we plan to do. Do you approve it? And they say, yes, no, change it, this, that, and the other. And there's dozens of them, hundreds of them. Often, think of them not as existing spaces. Think of them more as projections of a future plaza than a plaza that was actually in place at the particular time. You can miss maps. Are delusional in some places. Don't trust them, as you well probably know from trying to get on these highways in and around Columbus. I've gotten lost. These plans are there because municipal officers, that is in the archive, prior to constructing or restructuring their plaza, sought the approval of the Council of the Indies. And contemporary maps and plans further underscore the plaza's importance as a potent symbol of urban life, and the archetype being the map view of Tenochtitlan, prepared shortly after Hernan Cortes had conquered the city and renamed it Mexico City. And I'll get back to this map later on. But plazas also occupy center stage in virtually all of the town maps and plans of the colonial era. And here I'll just show you two, the town of Texupa near Oaxaca in the hill in southern Mexico, or Santiago Atitlan, alongside the lake that in Guatemala. These are part of the great geographical projects or Relaciones Geográficas that Philip the II ordered for the Americas in the 1570s, and in many cases we have they asked for maps of the region or the place that was being described, and this is the kind of material that was produced. And these are good examples of what would be called hybrid cartography that incorporate indigenous mapping techniques with Spanish techniques, and they've been brilliantly studied by Barbara Mundy in a fabulous book on the subject. Well, the plaza assumed even greater importance in city views that the famous Peruvian or indigenous chronicler Juan Pomar de Ayala incorporated in his early 17th century account of the governance of Peru. And here the plaza almost superseded the city, practically serving as a kind of an emblem or icon of the city as a whole. And there, what do I have? You have Huamanga, his home city, on the left, with a little justice being enacted there in the town square. And there you have the southern Peruvian town of Arequipa at the moment when the nearby volcano was showering ashes down on the town square. And there's a little, you can see the little religious procession crossing the square, and they brought out the local statue of the Virgin saying, "What the heck is going on here? Pity, por favor, un merced," something. They were desperate to get that rain to stop, hot rain. And you can also see the importance of the plaza in Juan de Botanzo's plan for an indigenous village, what they call a reducción. It was done in 1567. It was into these kinds of smaller urbanized spaces that Peruvian officials hoped to group Peru's native population, get them out of the status of barbaric in existence and urbanize them and give them a measure of policia. And in a sense, the purpose of these towns was to promote policia and get them out of the kinds of huts and dwellings that the famed Jesuit missionary Jose da Costa insultingly referred to as ortigueras de conejos, rabbit holes. Not a nice description. Well, additional testimony underscoring the importance of the plaza derives from contemporary chronicles and diaries, together with ongoing efforts to enhance the ornato, the urban embellishment of these spaces, and regulate the manner in which they were to be used. Cortez's account of Tenochtitlan's central square, twice as big as Salamanca, he writes, with arcades all around, where more than 60,000 people come each day to buy and sell. This is arguably the oldest description of a New World plaza, but it was soon echoed by that of Francisco Cervantes de Salazar, the transplanted Toledan humanist who became one of the first boosters of Mexico City. Seemingly undeterred by the mediocre quality of the buildings that then surrounded the city's recently constituted Plaza Mayor, the Zocalo, and the fact that that space often reeked of garbage and filth, Salazar, writing in Latin, was still able to make the following boast, and I quote, I don't think that its equal can be found in either hemisphere. Good heavens, how level and how spacious, how cheerful. What order, what beauty. What a situation and location. Hyperbole, no doubt. But when it came to describing plazas, whether in text or in image, language of this kind, the early modern equivalent of our bigger is better was practically de rigueur. Take Lima, a city whose Plaza Mayor was first laid out by Pizarro when he founded that city in 1535. Pizarro, however, did little to enhance the plaza's ornato, save for the construction of a gallows, picota, symbol of the harsh justice for which this conquistador was and is notorious. Lima's subsequent governors had other ideas. In the 1560s, the fourth Spanish viceroy to serve in Peru, a certain Diego de López de Zúñiga, is said to have, quote, ennobled the plaza when he ordered the construction of porticos and replaced Pizarro's picota with a fountain. A change that reflected this viceroy's rather more benevolent and benign interpretation of policia. And there is Juan Empoma's vision of the Plaza Mayor, and you can see there's still a gallows there, but there's the fountain right there in the middle. And later viceroys made other improvements to the same plaza, most famously the even more imposing bronze fountain that was erected by the Count of Salvatierra in 1651 and is still in situ today, what is called Lima's Plaza de Armas. And it's this kind of ornato that enabled one local chronicler writing in the 17th century to, in an attempt to just kind of one-up his counterparts in Mexico City, to describe his plaza, that is, Lima's plaza, as the largest and best-formed plaza I have ever seen, whether in the Indies or Spain. And even more effusive was the description of the same plaza offered by an 18th century writer, Pedro de Peralta Barnuevo. He referred to it as Lima's pride and joy, the theater of all its royal magnificence and the principal manifestation of its beauty, end of quote. I mean, you can just see the Chamber of Commerce pushing these places. Now, the importance, both symbolic and real, and you want to, if you really want to get a sense of the plaza, you can see it there in the lower center with the Picotto right there, in the middle. There's the layout, a sketch of the city in 1685 with a projection of walls that were really never built. But that's another problem. The importance, both symbolic and real, of Lima's plaza is further underscored by its place in the diaries of two 17th century Limeños, Juan Antonio Suardo, the other José Mugaburo. And reading these works, one can hardly turn a page without tripping across a reference to the Plaza Mayor. Neither Cenudo nor Mugaburo provide any indication of how much time they actually spent in the plaza. Or they were clearly apprised of what was happening there, both day and night. And from other sources, we know that Lima, despite a population of almost 30,000 inhabitants in the 17th century, remained what anthropologists called a face-to-face community, a community where news of events in one part of the city traveled quickly to other parts of the city. Or as one visitor put it, Lima is almost like a village, in that whenever something happens in one of its streets, within an hour, everybody in the city knows about it, just like the campus of OSU. There's a terrorist attack in one building, everybody across knows, and boom, they're out. So, or football victory or something, or basketball, whatever. It follows that happenings in the plaza pop up regularly in these two diaries. And they include religious processions of various sorts, among them the one that was organized in 1680 when the news of the beatification of Fray Toribio Alfonso de Mogrovejo in Rome had finally arrived in Lima, 2 years late, but no, this was all right. There were funeral processions there, among them the one honoring the death of the monarch Philip IV in 1666. And on the lighter side, the plaza served as a setting for bullfights and juegos de cañas, the game of canes that regularly pitted teams of horsemen dressed as Christians against others dressed as Moors. It was also the staging ground for a military parade, and it was served as the scenario for mock battles of various sorts, including the one organized in 1682 when a fortress constructed in the middle of the plaza, probably out of wood, was besieged by an army of invaders. And then, too, it served as the setting for firework displays on important holidays and public performances of comedies, dances, and the like. It was also in the plaza, just as Covarrubias has suggested, that justice was enacted and performed. In Mexico City, the native chronicler known as Chimalpain regularly recorded how blacks convicted of various crimes had their bodies mutilated and dismembered prior to meeting their ends on platforms that were especially erected for this purpose in the center of the Zócalo, Mexico's Plaza Mayor. It was the same in Lima, as Juan Empoma's view of this city suggests. And this same plaza served as the place where the local tribunal of the Inquisition organized its autos de fe, among them the one held in 1605, and which, according to one observer, was celebrated with much greater majesty than in Spain, because the plaza is transformed into a large theater and scaffold. The plaza also served as the backdrop for an even larger auto de fe stage on the 23rd of January, 1639, in which 10 new Christians of Portuguese extraction were ordered to be burned at the stake, and the burning would not take place in the plaza. You do it off site, so to speak. Cenudo's diary also reports that the same plaza served as the arena for public shamings of women accused of having gone astray, and also a place where the power and rigor of royal law was enacted, as on the 21st of January, 1667, when 8 natives accused of having planned an uprising were hung on gallows erected in the middle of the square. Or in 1676, when, once again, smack dab in the middle of the plaza, center stage, so to speak, a black man accused of having beheaded a priest also lost, Taliban style, that particular part of his body. But just as the plaza served as a stage for the enactment of justice, thus polytheia, it also had its dark side. It was frequently a site for disorder and crime, a place where local inhabitants, for one reason or another, regularly seemed to clash. The diaries of Sanudo and Mugabudo dwell on these acts of violence, both individual and collective, that occurred in Lima's Plaza Mayor. In September 1629, for example, Sanudo reports about a series of violent knife fights that broke out among several companies of soldiers gathered in the plaza. He called them cuchilladas. He does not specify the cause of this violence, but appears to have been connected to the fact that at least one of the companies involved in the fight was waiting to be shipped out to the Chilean front and continue the seemingly endless campaign to pacify the rebellious Mapuche, whose valor the Spanish writers Alonso de Ercilla celebrated in his epic poem, La Araucana. The plaza could also be murderous, both day and night. In 1630, Sanudo reports on the 18-year-old girl who was assaulted and stabbed to death by a black slave when crossing the plaza one evening. Later that year, two conversos, new Christian merchants of Portuguese origins, both with cajones, Richard. Woo! Maybe cajones too, but we don't know. both with cajones, stalls in the plaza, got into an argument about an unpaid debt. Tempers flared, shouts reverberated across the plaza, and the argument ended when one of the two, still in the plaza, pulled out a knife and proceeded to stab and kill the other. Such incidents were not necessarily daily occurrences, but they do suggest that life in the plaza was not always in keeping with the norms of polytheia, let alone the image of Lima that its publicists sought to project. It was the same elsewhere. In the plaza, order and disorder marched side by side. One example, Cusco, a city high in the Andes, where the plaza was represented by a third of what had been Inca Cusco's immense central square. Spaniards cut it down to make it more manageable, still pretty big. This plaza served as a place where Cusqueños gathered to celebrate important religious festivals, such as that of Corpus Christi. And they also gathered, and here's the lovely 17th century painting of same, in front of the Cathedral of Cusco, or where they gathered to offer collective prayers in times of crisis, such as the destructive earthquake that shook the city in 1647, destroying much of it. And the people, they dragged out all the icons and the images and virgins and they could get and crosses and said, "Poor, no more, no more." And this painting is hanging in the Cathedral of Cusco today. But the plaza also served as a place where local inhabitants resolved their grievances of various types. And one of the enduring conflicts throughout the colonies was the struggle between Spaniards and criollos, that is to say Creoles, Spaniards, people born in the Americas of Spanish extraction. And these battles between Spaniards and criollos, and they battled over access to offices, privileges, and honors of various sorts. The general outline of these conflicts is fairly well known, but a particular interest, at least to me, is the incident that occurred in the Plaza Mayor of Cusco on the 30th of March, 1698, and described by Diego Esquivel y Navia, a local chronicler. March 30th of that year marked Easter Sunday, a day normally reserved for religious observances, processions, and the like. But as Esquivel y Navia reports, the plaza that day served also as the site for noisy scuffles among Europeans. He also referred to them as Basques, Vizcaínos, and those in this native land, meaning the criollos. As he tells it, the Vizcaínos shouted, "Now's a good time to kill these mestizos," That is to say, these are people of mixed blood. And to refer to the Creoles as mestizos was clearly meant as a nasty insult. And at the end of the day, there was a fight which left at least one Vizcaíno wounded. Well, more than just an isolated incident, this fight underscores the extent to which the plaza in Cusco, as elsewhere, was something other than an utopian space, and thus totally out of keeping with the idea of policía, let alone that of the so-called ordered city described by the Uruguayan writer Ángel Rama in his influential book, A Ciudad Letrada, the lettered city, as he called it. The plaza could also be dystopic, a site for both conflict and crime, and in Mexico City, a place where prostitutes, both male and female, were known to hawk their wares, especially during the night, and also the place where the occasional murder took place. And here I'm thinking of the incident in July 1685, when a mulatta woman killed her husband in plain sight of the merchants gathered in one of the porticos that lined that immense square. It's as if you wanted to kill somebody right there in the middle of the plaza on center stage to maximize the insult that took place, or the hatred that was being embodied by that act. Well, then as now, moreover, the plaza served as the ideal spot for protest, the space where irate citizens, for various reasons, gathered to express discontentment in front of the very institutions, the cathedral, the cabildo, the archiepiscopal residence, the viceregal palace, responsible for the enforcement of policía in both the spiritual and temporal sphere. If you're going to protest Wall Street, where do you want to go? As close to it as possible, right? You don't want to do it up by Columbia. You don't want to do it at Fifth Avenue. You want to go right down there as close as you can get. They won't let you to Wall Street, but there's a park nearby. Clean, I hear. Now, the colonial record is, of course, shot through with protests, with riots, and uprisings of various sorts. None more famous than the riot that occurred in Mexico City in June 1692, when groups of disgruntled artisans, white, mestizo, indigenous, and black, gathered in the Zocalo to protest the food shortages resulting from the disastrous policies of the Spanish viceroy, Gaspar de Silva, Count of Gelves. And on June 8th, amid shouts of Viva el Rey y muera el mal gobierno, long live the king and death the bad government, the crowd set fire to the viceregal palace, igniting a conflagration that not only destroyed much of the building's facade, as you can see, he was in the process of being rebuilt, but it's still half in ruins, and took about 20 years to rebuild. Eventually, order was restored, as this painting by Cristobal de Villalpando. And once again, he's presenting kind of a city, a view where kind of policía, order, harmony, is on view. He said, "This is, you know, it's all very peaceful now. There's a memory of that old destruction, but it's just a memory. It's just a kind of a one little discordant note, but as if it's there's as if the artist wanted to remind you of the fact that this disorder had took place. It's enigmatic how to read this particular image, but otherwise the images we have of the colonial city." The map, so to speak, with few exceptions, are invariably utopian. Call it pictorialized policía, and that's what we're seeing here. In many ways, the template derives. I can just show you. I love this one because the viceroy has come out. You see him in his little coach down there at the left. You can just cut off. He's peering out there at his plaza, saying all these happy Indians and natives and blacks, they're all gathered together. Commerce is going on. There's nothing wrong with Mexico City. At least it's this image of Mexico City I want to show my friends back in Spain. And we'll come back to that idea. But so this kind of pictorialized policía. And this idea, the template, so to speak, derives from the Cortes view of Tenochtitlan, which in addition to the importance it accorded to the city's central plaza, also represents the plaza, the former Aztec capital, as a city where Christianity is already in force. And just look at the image of the Templo Mayor, the great temple that's up at the in the detail on the right, you can see that small cross across one of the pyramids of that temple, together with the decapitated idol below. In other words, policía has been established in the city. Christianity has planted itself on top of the old pyramid, and the idol, the symbol of the former gods, is now powerless, headless, lying on the ground. Now, there are many other images of urban utopias dating from the colonial period. Most demonstrably, in this anonymous 1680 painting of Lima, as represented by the Plaza Mayor. In both, and here particularly, policia reigns supreme, and there's not one discord note to be seen. And once again, you see a wholly harmonious assemblage of people, rich and poor, black, indigenous, mestizo and white, each minding their respective business and attending to their own affairs. You see elegant Spanish ladies parading about on horseback, others out for a ride in their opulent carriages, a prosperous gentleman out for a stroll followed by a black slave with an umbrella that protects him from the sun. And in the foreground, on the right, members of the Cabildo, and on the far lower right, a gentleman clothed in white, possibly the Spanish viceroy. In sum, a visual summary of polythea, order, harmony, prosperity, religion, all of it is on display. At the same, and see also, you go into little details, you see native vendors crowded into the plaza. They offer a kind of an excellent illustration of the extent to which Lima's indigenous population had seemingly inundated and then appropriated the plaza for their own uses, adopting it to their own way of life. And if we go back, if you look closely on the, and this painting has yet to be studied in detail. In fact, we don't even know where the painting is. It was brought to Spain at some point, but I'll get to that in a second. There's a list of various local fruits, avocados, chirimoyas, papas, piñas, fish like cabrilla y pejerrey. Basically, they're now part of the domestic lexicon, the food of the conquistadors, so to speak. And there's a wonderful new book soon to be published on this by Rebecca Earle called The Body of the Conquistador. It will be published in a few months by Cambridge University Press. Overall, this painting serves as an excellent illustration of what Serge Grudzinski, in reference to the hybrid nature of colonial societies that emerged in the Spanish, in the wake of the Spanish conquest, what Grudzinski called cultural mestizaje, cultural mixing, a term that suggests the cultural interchange and borrowings of various sorts. And here it is done in a with reference to a particular place. Now, I could continue in this particular vein with more such views, but time does not permit. The point is when we look at these pictures, we're looking at what amounts to a visual stereotype, or the particular quasi-utopian manner in which the artists who executed these images, the way in which they wanted these cities to be seen, as opposed to the way they actually were. Now, if I were showing you, images I am showing you, images of 17th century New Amsterdam, you see the same thing, an ordered, wholly harmonious, somewhat utopian view of the fledgling settlement, there with the policy, with the gallows there, right there in Battery Park, symbol of the kind of justice that takes place, at least below 14th Street, in that part of the town. It's Manhattan, of course. And it turns out, of course, these views were commissioned by the Dutch West India Company, the entity initially responsible for the creation of New Amsterdam, and one whose directors were not only looking for merchants to invest in what was fundamentally a struggling economy or colony, but also hoping to recruit Dutchmen willing to cross the Atlantic and help that settlement to grow. In this sense, the utopian view of the ordered city was something like an advertisement. In the sense, we know that they're placed on public view in offices of the Dutch West India Company in various parts of Netherlands, incorporated the geographical compendium, in the sense they represented efforts to sell this particular city to would-be emigrants and investors in the old world. And I could say the same of this wonderful view by Peters of Recife, the principal settlement in Dutch Brazil, which was done in 1640s. And I could do this, think of William Penn's Philadelphia in the same way. In a sense, we see once again pictorialized Philadelphia, generally with an eye towards marketing this image, this place, this city in the old world, to investors and to immigrants, would-be immigrants, back in the UK. Not the UK yet, Britain. In comparison, the Spanish American cities were not run by joint stock companies, nor colonial entrepreneurs desperate for immigrants to increase the size of the local population. In addition, most of the images we have of these cities were not made for export per se, but designed either to be placed on display in the town halls and churches of the town itself, or commissioned for private use. And at the start of the 18th century, for example, the Spanish viceroy known as the Marqués de Castel dos Ríos, hard name, Dos Ríos, basically, he's Catalan, having served as viceroy for a few years in Peru, returned to Spain with a collection of maps and pictures that included several Peruvian towns, among them a painting described as Lima y su Plaza. Quite possibly something similar to the image now on the screen, and quite possibly. It can't be because the dates are wrong. But what this suggests is that these views were not advertisements designed to help sell Lima to would-be European investors. More likely, they were meant to serve as kind of aide-memoirs, reminders of the viceroy's tenure in Peru, and beyond that, provide an avowedly utopian visual record of this official's accomplishments in the New World. In other words, when I was there, this is the kind of city, harmonious, ordered, I was able to create. So if so, when we look at these images, what exactly is being mapped? And here I'll bring this talk to a close. On the surface, you see a topographical place. What you see is Lima's Plaza Mayor, its main square. But on another level, it's also mapping, metaphorically, a concept, policía, as reflected in the order and harmonious relations of the people gathered in this particular place. In this sense, the image is intended to place a wholly positive spin on the viceroy's mode of governance and simultaneously offer visual proof of the success of the Spanish monarchy's broader imperial project, namely that of using cities as instruments to establish order throughout the New World. The message is clear. Policía resided in the plaza, and with specific reference to Lima, I can return to this guy I cited before, Pedro de Peralta, and he neatly summarized this concept, this linkage between Policía and plaza, in a god-awful poem that he wrote in 1723, which I will read in Spanish and then I will translate into English. En este civil claro senado el capital yace, hay en cuyo asiento del vicio y del desorden han triunfado. I will translate. In this luminous civil senate, the capital lies, having triumphed over the vice and disorder of the place. Thank you very much. No, time is right. Good. Man's on fire.
Just a quick one. I just wonder if, of the sources you've seen, were the majority of the acts of disorder that were reported performed by marginalized members of society? Because the examples you gave were generally a black slave or a couple black slaves and Portuguese conversos. So I was just wondering if the majority of the reports of disorder are of
well, I'm citing only chroniclers here, and so therefore, they may have been particularly attuned to the fact that these are the people we don't like necessarily. I'm going to make sure to record these as opposed to those committed by the Vizcaínos, or there's that one case in Cusco where it's basically Vizcaínos versus Criollos. Now, this is a really good doctoral dissertation if somebody wants to do this. Any volunteers? There must be criminal records, and I don't know how good they are for downtown Lima or downtown Mexico City in the 17th and 18th century, but if you wanted to do a kind of a topographical analysis of crime on the of public public disorder on the basis of the surviving criminal records, and it would be a very interesting thing to map it not just socially, but to map it topographically, which isn't yet, to my knowledge, been done for any South American city in the 16th and the 17th centuries. Maybe I assume now that the government of Mexico knows exactly where heads are being cut off and where, but we haven't done this for the 16th and 17th century. So in a sense, I assume the sources are somewhat biased. But Chimalpaín, you could read. He's a marginal. He's Christianized native. It's the blacks that he comments about. So I think the sources are a bit distorted, but I haven't done that kind of criminal research. It's your generation that's going to do that. Get thee to Lima. It's a far way. It's far from the high hills of Castile, but. No, that's only at the act of creation. No, they don't. If you go to Lima, Mexico City today, towns of 20 million people in Mexico City, the Zócalo hasn't really changed, nor has the Plaza de Armas or any of these places. No, the idea is if I could have showed you late 18th century foundational plans, it's the same idea. You can go to South, you can go to San Antonio, you can go to Bejer de la, whatever it was called, you can go to Santa Fe. The idea is still in place. They were free to choose the actual size of the plaza, but they had to thought about it in terms of ratio to population. But I don't know. There were a few Spaniards, lots of Indians, lots of blacks. They built bigger plazas than they needed. They wanted to show off a little bit, but they also wanted to be able to close it off, and sort of circle the wagon, so to speak, in case the natives got restless, which occasionally happened. But the idea, the ordinances were not revised. Now they didn't say you need a bigger plaza, but the city remains. The plaza remains the plaza. The city grows around it, so it fills in the space. It's rather rigid, rather bureaucratic, but those rules were not, to my knowledge, they were not revised even by the Bourbons in the 18th century.
The ordinances are very detailed.
Yes. You mean we have very few views from the early modern period of parts of the city other than the plaza. It's the plaza is what you show off. It's what you want to capture it. Sometimes you get some porticos. Sometimes you get this kind of view, this kind of view. You get a bird's eye. You get a horizontal. You get a map. But we don't have the back streets are not being mapped.
We don't know where the tanneries are.
We know where they are. But they're not being depicted, because this stuff basically they're either being commissioned for, let's say, this kind of part of my CV. This is the CV. I'm not going to show you the downside, right? I'm only going to show you the upside, hopefully. And then the other part that you get when you build something, the projects that have to be approved by the Council of the Indies in Madrid, then, and you don't really need permission to alter the back streets, side plazas. It's the main plaza that counts. So we have some images of some of the, let's say, the Plaza de San Agustin, the Plaza de Inquisition in Mexico City, 18th century paintings. But time and again, you're going back to the plaza. This is where it's taking place. All the rest is secondary. It's the iconic structure of the town. And you measure it, its worth, its importance, its governance on the basis of this space. Iconic space rather than structure. Odd, but it's... Who's Daniela? Oh, Daniela.
I wonder why they include a black population and indigenous people coexisting, right? Because it's well known that these plazas or these cities were surrounded by walls that were closed at the end of the day to protect the city, to protect Spaniards from the rest of the population, right? So I wonder why they want to show that coexistence, like this happy coexistence. And also, a follow-up question is, after the rebellion of Lucas Amaro II, I wonder if these kind of paintings changed and they didn't show indigenous people anymore, or how would they interact?
The last one's a really good one, because I don't know the answer. Because you're telescoping it. If you look at Martinez Compagnon's, that late very tale of the 18th century compendium of views, it's all looks like this basically, and that's post Tupac Amaro. Now the first question is more complicated, because there are no walls. Number one, Spanish cities don't have walls initially. Havana gets walls, Cartagena gets walls, Callao gets walls, but the vast majority of Spanish cities are what Alberti called naked cities. A naked city is a wall-less city. Why don't you wall a city? Well, everybody in Europe, you wall cities to keep malefactors out, keep the citizens in. Keep the taxpayers where you want them, right? And in theory, keep other things out and find places to tax. They wanted these cities to grow and expand. The whole idea is to kind of urbanize the whole continent, because they want to bring those barbaros in the space. And there's and the governor of Florida, if I remember, Mendez de Avila, he says that when the natives see the walls going up, the buildings going up, the natives would be amazed. They'll be impressed. They want to Christianize themselves. So there are no walls, except there is a space within inside of Lima called the Cercado, which is that's inside the city, which is the reducción. It's the indigenous space built by the Jesuits as a kind of inside the city to protect them, and that's a special. It's the only one of its kind. We have a city within the city, like what we call a ghetto, like you would get think Venice or Florence in the late Middle Ages. That's unique. The other thing is that what the point is that policía is to embrace all of these social groups, and so you don't really have policía unless the native inhabitants have been Hispanized, Christianized, and the like. So they're trying to collapse the theoretical república de indios and the república de cristianos or españoles that supposedly characterized the city. It's a theoretical construct. There's no such. It's a single republic, and that's one point they're trying to make. And the second point, I think, is that they're also trying to show, and in another lecture on this, another spin on this talk, they're trying to say that look, despite all of the racial heterogeneity, the racial complex, racial admixture, which Europeans would complain about. If you read the 18th century commentators, 17th century commentators, all the Spaniards are going native, they're eating native foods, they're eating pejerre, they're eating avocados, they're eating cabrilla, they're eating those things that we don't understand, they're eating corn, they're chocolate, all this stuff, smoking. They're becoming indigenized. And you think of the Costa paintings, and I could show you one, of a whole, it's order. It's a hierarchy with the Spaniards where on top. And once again, they're saying despite the racial heterogeneity, there's harmony, there's order in the Americas, created by whom? The Spaniards, and implemented by the viceroy, the cabildo, and ecclesiastical officials. That is precisely those individuals who we think commissioned works such as these. And we generally don't know who the patrons were or who commissioned them. But when I found that document about that 18th century viceroy saying, bring back pictures of Lima, thank goodness. Thank you for listening.